Fear to Tread by James Swallow. Read by Gareth Armstrong. War is Hell. Willem Tecumseh Sherman. Recovered Writings of the Age Before Night. M7. If one wishes to go unseen by devils, one should not place their faith in angels. Attributed to the Remembrancer, Ignace Carcassi, M31. Melchior. The war that came to Melchior was fought by gods and angels. It cracked sky and earth, burned mountains, and turned oceans to ash. But in the end, it was all about a single objective. On the white salt plains of the Silver Desert, where millions of conscripts and faithful had toiled to build the praise towers and empath chapels, the Nephilim gathered for the last fight. Over the months of the war, they had fallen back, leaving each battleground behind, no matter if they had been the victors or the vanquished. It was almost as if the towns, the plainslands, and the canyons had been tainted to them by the shedding of blood. The Nephilim turned their backs and threaded away, and slowly it became clear where they were heading. From orbit, once their egg-like star craft had been killed and void superiority lost to them, the lines of displacement were wide enough to be seen with the naked eye. Streams of figures, black ribbons of refugees being herded from each point of the compass, plain against the landscape like the dark plumes of smoke from the burned cities. The war of the gods and angels could have been ended from that high vantage point. It would have required only the time and patience needed to drive the enemy into their last stronghold and then bombard it into oblivion. But this was not that kind of battle, nor were those who fought it inclined to stand and wait. There were affronts of great scale that needed to be answered in kind, lessons to be learned and demonstrations to be made to the galaxy at large. The Nephilim had offended, and they had to be seen to be punished for their crime. And then there were the people. Not all of them sang the hymnals, their faces streaked with joyful tears as they looked up at the giants that walked among their number. Not all of them gave everything they had, from chattel to firstborn, at the word of the Nephilim. Many were among the multitude without choice, shackled and made slaves. They deserved to be freed. To suggest they be sacrificed on the altar of war was unconscionable. Some said all the worshippers were slaves, if one were to widen the definition. In the end, the point was moot. To free the people of Melchior, the Nephilim had to be exterminated, down to the very last of them. On that point, there was no disagreement. In the heart of the Silver Desert, on the sparkling white gypsum, wreathed in waves of radiated solar heat, the Nephilim gathered with their great entourage among the broken rocks and escarpments, and there they sang their peculiar ululating songs and toiled at the copper frames of their constructions, waiting for the enemy to come. Knights in moon-pale armour, trimmed with black, formed a massive phalanx of ceramite, shields and guns. There were 8,000 of them, the marching of their booted feet crunching the top layer of salted soil into powder, which swirled into the air as fine as paper smoke. White upon white, wreathed in haze, they seemed to float towards the edges of the great Nephilim encampment on a rumble of sound, a peal of thunder that had no ending to it. At the edge of their battalions were war machines, battle tanks, hovering skimmers supported by invisible columns of contragravity, low and blocky things that resembled armor-plated trilobites, fighting vehicles that bristled with gun barrels. Peering out above the mist, there were hundreds of battle standards and pennants. They carried variant designs of the sigil on the shoulders of the warriors, the black face of a sly canine with a crescent moon beneath its snout, along with unit citations and squadron marks. The tallest flag, the one that rode at the very tip of the formation, had a unique design, an eye rendered in a manner that resembled sigils of Terra's antiquity, open and daring, watchful, like that of a predator. The pennant was carried by a champion among champions, and he stood resplendent in an artificer-wrought armour, marching at the right arm of a demigod, a master of war. Horus Lupercal, Primarch of the Lunar Wolves and Lord of the 16th Legion Astartes, halted in his tracks and raised a heavy, gauntleted hand, pointing into the lines of barricades and revetments marking the edge of the Nephilim host. A ripple broke back across the ranks of his warriors as they too came to a stop and awaited his commands. The hard, severe light of Melchior's sun cast a fathomless black shadow at his feet. "You see them, Captain?" Horus asked softly, without turning to his subordinate. Captain Hastur Sejanus, praetor of the 4th Company of the Lunar Wolves, nodded grimly. The near hit of a Nephilim shriek pulse earlier in the campaign had damaged the bones of his skull, and they were knitting together well, but the healing process had the side effect of giving him a constant low-level headache. The gnawing pain made him irritable and robbed Sejanus of his good humour. The giants were on the move, surging forwards from their encampment. The captain of the 4th heard the whistling, tremulous noise of their sing-song voices as they came, and the cries of the men and women who rushed to get out of their way. Massive footfalls drummed across the taut surface of the desert sands. Horus tipped back his head, looking away, up and up, into the near cloudless sky. For a moment, the commander seemed uninterested in the enemy approach. Sejanus glanced around at his lieutenants and made quick gestures in battle sign, ordering the heavy support and dreadnought units arranged along the edges of the Lunar Wolves formation to make ready. Las cannons, heavy Draco pattern bolters, and magazine-fed missile launchers were prepared. Behind him, the captain heard the sound of 8,000 weapons being armed. "Here they are," he said, compelled to say something as the first of the alien giants rose up and stepped over the inner, human-scaled barriers of their bulwark. The Nephilim had a kind of unhurried, careful agility that reminded Sejanus of sea-going creatures seen through the walls of a glass tank. They moved through air as if they were swimming in water, deceptively slow. But he had seen firsthand how fast they could go if they wished, darting and spinning, becoming difficult to hit. Sejanus was ready to give the order there and then, but Horus sensed his intent and shook his head. "One final chance," he said. "We've come this far. We may still be able to save lives." And before Sejanus could answer, his liege lord was walking forwards, out of the lines of the ranks, towards the closest of the colossal Xenos. It was a grey. Sejanus had absorbed the surveillance data on the aliens via a hypnagogic transfer, and he knew what little the intelligence officers of the Imperial Army had gleaned about the command structure of the Nephilim. The colours of their bloated, oblate bodies seemed to designate general rank and position. The blue were rank and file types, often at the front lines. The green seemed to perform a role similar to that of an apothecary, or perhaps a squad sergeant. The grey were apparently commanders, thought of as captains by the analysts, for want of a better word. Attempts to translate the screeching native speech of the aliens had proven fruitless. The upper registers of the sounds existed in hypersonic ranges that were beyond even the reach of a space marine's gen-enhanced hearing. That, coupled with the strange light patterns that flashed over the lines of photophores in their skin, made breaking their tongue a fool's effort. The Nephilim had no trouble doing the reverse, however. They had come to Melchior speaking Imperial Gothic as if they had been born to it, and what they said had denied a whole star system to the rule of distant Terra and the Emperor of Mankind. The Grey saw Horus and moved towards him, light flashes on its epidermis, sending a silent command to the lines of greens and blues forming up behind it. They halted, and around their thick pillar-like legs, Sejanus saw humans clustering to the aliens in the same way that children would cling to a mother. The converts were all armed with weapons looted from Melchior's planetary defence forces. Their faces were faintly visible behind the thick translucent masks that they wore. The masks blurred their aspects, making their features seem uniform and unfinished. The Intelligence Corps believed that the conscript masks were made from the epidermal layers of Nephilim flesh. Greens had been observed cutting out patches of their own skin for this ritualistic process, and it was theorized that somehow the wearing of the alien flesh bonded the conscripts to their Xenos slave masters. Sejanus had personally observed a post-battle autopsy on a dead Nephilim and seen the profusion of wiry innards and gelatinous organs that made up the forms of these things. Hulking entities of roughly humanoid outline, they were smooth like carvings of soapstone, with abstract shapes approximating arms and legs. Their dome heads emerged from their shoulders without a neck, and an array of olfactory slits and eye spots ringed the surface of their skulls. In this light, the Nephilim looked like things of blown glass, their semi-transparent flesh glowing in the bright day. Horus halted, the grey bending slightly to look down at him. Each of the Xenos stood over twice the height of the tallest legionary. "I will make the offer one last time," Horus told the creature. "Release your thralls and leave this place. Do this now in the Emperor's name." The Nephilim's photophores glistened, and it spread its stubby, three-fingered hands in a gesture of false openness that it must have copied from a human. The air in front of the alien vibrated as an invisible pane of force rippled into being. Strange harmonics whistled and hummed. This was how the Xenos spoke, creating an external ethereal tympanic membrane, manipulating the passage of air molecules through some as yet undetermined means. It wasn't psychic in nature, that had been ascertained already, but technological, some kind of instrumentality bonded into their organic forms.
"Why do you oppose us?" it asked. "The need does not exist. We want peace."
Horus placed one hand on the pommel of the sword at his waist. "That is a falsehood. You came here unbidden, and you took a name from the ancient mythology, that of Terra, Caliban, and Barak."
"Nephilim,"
it sang, its voice high and peculiar, sounding out each syllable of the word.
"The fallen seraphs."
The grey took a heavy step closer to the Primarch, and Sejanus's hand reflexively tightened around the grip of his storm bolter.
"Worship them. Praise us. Find peace. Find peace."
The humans huddling at the foot of the aliens echoed the words as if they were a benediction. Horus's attention never once strayed from the alien. "You are parasites," he said, his words carrying on the wind across the plains, breaking the silence that followed. "We know how you draw your sustenance. You feed on the emanations of life. Our imperial psychers have seen it. You need to be adored, to be worshipped like gods."
"That,"
it said, the sound voice humming,
"that is a kind of peace."
"And with your technology, you control minds and cage spirit. Human minds, human spirits." Horus shook his head. "That cannot stand."
"You cannot stop us."
The grey gestured towards the acres of copper towers and strange antennae behind it. There were thousands of the Nephilim now, a sea of giants moving forwards in slow, loping steps.
"We have fought you. We know your way. And you can only win if you kill those you profess to protect."
It pointed at a group of converts. The alien made the hand gesture again, trains of white light moving under its skin.
"Join us. We will show you. You will understand how beautiful it is to be in communion, to be at once a god and a mortal."
For a moment, Sejanus thought he saw something dark pass over Horus's face. Then the instant was gone. "We have dethroned all the gods," said the Primarch, "and you are only pale shadows of those false things." The grey let off a hooting cry in its own language, and the legion of Nephilim advanced, each of them phosphorescing an angry yellow.
"We will destroy you," it said. "We outnumber you."
Horus gave a rueful nod and drew his sword, a massive blade of oiled steel and adamantium. "You will try," he said. "But today you face the Emperor's sons and his warriors. We are the Lunar Wolves, and this legion is the anvil upon which you will be broken." From high overhead, there was a low crackle and a sound like distant thunder as sonic booms from the upper atmosphere reached the desert floor. Sejanus looked up, his acute eyesight picking out lines of white contrails, hundreds in number, flaring out behind great crimson tears and scarlet-hued hawks as they fell at supersonic speeds towards the silver sands. "We are the anvil," Horus repeated, pointing with his sword. "Now, behold the hammer." The heavens screamed. ejected from the launch tubes of a dozen capital ships and battle barges in low orbit, a rain of ceramite capsules tore through the outer atmosphere of Melchior and fell like flaming meteors towards the Silver Desert. Falling with them were diving hawks, stormbirds and assault gunships, turning and wheeling through the air towards the gargantuan Nephilim encampment. They were red as blood, red as fury, and they carried company upon company of the warriors of the 9th Legion Astartes. The speed of their assault was the key to victory. The alien invaders and their zealots had successfully been drawn out to confront the massed forces of the Lunar Wolves, leaving the defences on their flanks thinned and permeable. But the Xenos giants were not slow in their thinking, and the moment they understood that they had been duped, they would attempt to regroup and fortify. The Blood Angels would not allow that to happen. The Nephilim would be broken and cut down, their cohesion shattered by the brutal deep strike that even now was moments from point of impact. The first skirling impulse of sonic power shot up past the descending assault force, energetic beams of oscillating air sparking spontaneous flashes of heat lightning. Down in the desert, the quickest of the aliens were reaching their thick arms upwards as if groping for the high clouds, using the resonance of their glassy skeletons as waveguides for the shriek attacks. Drop pods, clipped by the sound beams, went off course, spiraling out of the landing quadrant towards the white salt erg. Others, not so fortunate, ripped open or slammed into brutal collision with their fellows. The lead Stormbird, crimson like its cohorts, but adorned with wings of gold, wove a course through the sonic barrage, guiding the flock into a blazing power dive. Heavy lasers and missile pods about its nose and wings spat fire back towards the Nephilim defenders, blasting black craters in the hard-packed sand. They were closing with each passing second, but were still too high for accurate targeting. Instead, the Stormbird's gunnery crews were suppressing the enemy far below, forcing them to open up the space where the warriors would make planetfall. And when the point of no return was crossed, the red and gold aircraft turned into a tight descending spiral. Across the ventral hull, plates of metal unlocked and slid back along hydraulic piston rails, allowing the howling air into the open compartment revealed behind them. Other aircraft in the formation did the same, hatches releasing to bear their interiors to the sky. From the lead Stormbird came a figure clad in armour, the shade of the sun. A Primarch, another demigod, an angel. He threw himself into the pale sky, embracing the pull of gravity like a lover, letting it speed him towards terminal velocity. Unmasked, his gallant face set in determination, a mane of flashing tresses snapping in the wind, he cried out his defiance. From his back there was an explosion of white as snowy pinions unfurled, great wings extending out in wide arcs to catch the flow of the air and effortlessly harness it. Gold trinkets, teardrops of precious red jade and ruby, silk tabards, and chainmail of platinum rattled against a suit of ceramite and plasteel so ornate, so glorious, that its artistry seemed better suited to a gallery of the highest reckoning. Against the drag of the airflow, he unsheathed a wicked red sword with a curved barbed hilt. It was the cousin to the blade held by his brother, Horus, far below. With him were warriors no less determined, no less fierce in countenance. Assault legionaries of a dozen companies bore down with the snarling jets of jump packs upon their backs, guns in their hands, and retribution hard in their eyes. Leading them were the sanguinary guard, whose golden armour and white wings echoed those of their liege lord, but the wings that held the guard aloft were made of enamelled metal, and like the assault squads, their flight was powered by spears of orange flames from blazing fusion motors. The Primarch landed with an impact greater than a point-blank barrage from a Vindicator, a perfectly circular ripple of shock resonating out from the crash of his boots upon the desert sands. Nephilim Blues, rushing to attack, were blasted off their feet, and they struggled to right themselves, only to be gunned down by the ornate wrist-bolters of the falling Sanguinary Guard and the fusillade of the assault squads. The Angel Sanguinius drew up from the crater his arrival had shaped, and met his first foe. A bellowing Nephilim Green came hurtling at him, shouting pulses of sonic disruption powerful enough to shatter bone and break rock. The alien towered over the Primarch, and its lucent flesh was alight with violent, flickering speech colour. There was a crackling cadence as it ran, the outer dermal layer of skin hardening into a natural sheath of misted, glassy armour. His sword tip rose up in a bright arc of glittering metal and met the Nephilim in the centre of its torso mass. The blade bit into the glass skin and shattered it effortlessly, fragments pealing with tinny bell tones as they ricocheted off the Primarch's battle plate. The weapon went on, deep and true, the monomolecular edge slicing through into gelatinous internals, breaking silicon bones and opening up the alien to the air. Bifurcated, the green-skinned creature came apart with a death howl that ripped into the dust as it collapsed. Sanguinius shook silvery metallic blood off his blade and threw a nod to his honour host. Each of them looked back at him with a mirror of the Primarch's own aspect, their helmets sculpted into a noble ideal of his face.
"First blood, Ascalon," he said, addressing his words to the commander of the guard.
"It is fitting, my lord," said the warrior, tense with the rush of imminent war.
Sanguinius nodded once.
"My sons know their mission. Strike hard and strike fast."
Ascalon saluted, removing his helm to present the hard lines of his face to his master.
"Your will."
As he spoke, the rumble of the remainder of the landing stormbirds was joined by the crashing impacts of the drop pods. The ground quaking beneath them, the ceramite teardrops slammed into the sand and split open like the blossoming of lethal flowers. Line warriors emerged from each pod in combat-ready formations, alongside librarians, black-armoured wardens, and battle apothecaries. Ascalon saw them all look to Sanguinius for their lead. Like them, he was proud to be here, in the company of his progenitor and primarch.
"No Xenos will be spared," he promised.
Sanguinius raised his sword in a return salute.
"The others..."
The angel didn't say the words, but the guard commander knew who he meant. The slaves.
"Liberate as many as you can. They'll fight with us now they know they have not been forsaken."
"And the conscripts?"
Ascalon pointed towards a rough skirmish line of the masked human worshippers as they advanced warily towards the red-armoured legionaries.
"If they oppose us?"
A moment of sorrow passed over the great angel's aspect, dimming his radiance for an instant.
"Then they too will be set free."
Sanguinius held up his blade, and the gesture brought a roar from his assembled sons that beat at the sky. A cohort of lumbering blues crested a low ridge, and the battle began in earnest for the Blood Angels. At the start, it had been Horus who called the tune of the battle plans. In the strategium of his flagship, the Vengeful Spirit, the master of the Lunar Wolves faced his brother across a wide hololithic display and showed him the plan he had conceived to break the will of the Nephilim. It was shock and awe, an implacable and showy display of combat might, the kind that Sanguinius's sibling had made his own time and again throughout the wars of the Great Crusade. In a sea of red and white, Horus wanted the Blood Angels to march shoulder to shoulder with their cousins, cowing the aliens with the sight of an army of thousands rolling without pause to the gates of their last bastion. And then, through those gates, over the battlements, not stopping, not pausing to parley or hesitate.
"Like the ocean these things sprang from," Horus had said, "we will roll over the aliens, drag them down, and drown them."
The sheer bombast of the plan was its greatest strength, but Sanguinius had not been easily swayed to it. Across the hololith,